Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they did. They got it so correct, it's unbelievable. And this is Tom Novolis, your host. I did want to make sure I gave you a proper introduction this week. I usually get really busy in all the items that we have to cover. And as with today, there is a lot to go over. You can look at the newsletter and the more details and references for today's program at samueladamsreturns.net, and I encourage you to do so. I am also going to put a plug in. This is not advertising or paid for anything, but our company, Peppers Numeric for Fun, so peppersforfun.com, is back up and in business, so you can go there for what we do in relationship to our pepper products and jams. Now, let's get back to last week for just a moment, and I'm not going to dig back into that whole political psychology on Sam Adams right now. This week, we're going to take a look at the 14th Amendment debt limit and then Althusius on federalism. And the important reason that I want to do that, the critical aspect around it, is that with the O'Biden administration rejecting negotiations on the debt ceiling, it has been more than rumored that they're going to invoke the 14th Amendment to raise the debt ceiling as from an administrative fiat. Well, first off, the whole federal banking system is a fiat, but more so, the idea of using the 14th Amendment to take and raise the debt ceiling, once again, a total misuse of the 14th Amendment. And we'll get into some of the specifics. And as much as I have studied the 14th Amendment a lot, let me put it that way, I will not qualify myself as some kind of super scholar around the 14th Amendment, not whatsoever. But I do have enough insights, and I will bring you into the critical references on the 14th Amendment that you should get or should have the ability to think through and know that it has been misused for about 100 years to destroy how the foundational functions of original intent in relationship to our Constitution have gone into effect. These are nefarious people with ideologies that are contrary to the liberties of individuals that utilize the 14th Amendment falsely to say that it's about individual rights, and that's what the 14th Amendment expands on. So we'll get to that. I just want to take a quick moment to talk about the CNN program the other night, where it was a town hall, I believe, that President Trump participated in and did a real slam dunk on CNN. It was amazing. I just watched the clips, I read the reviews, and I watched the left explode all over different social media platforms, especially the communists like AOC. Just, you know, they're should have pulled her hair out. It would have been amazing to watch that. But the fact of the matter is that truth will prevail. And that's what we've been hearing from Tucker Carlson and what he was saying. And once again, whatever your views are on President Trump, the fact of the matter is he is a New York scrapper. He can scrap with the best of them. And he does not take any nonsense, which we need to take on the evils that are there. And we're going to talk about the evils that are there as we look at the 14th Amendment. We look at the idea that how when you misinterpret things based on your ideologies and your belief systems, that it becomes perverted. And that's what I want to take you through in these last, oh, whatever, 10 minutes as we get into the 14th Amendment. And I want to talk about that. So the opening portions for today's program is on the 14th Amendment. And over the last couple of weeks, even Janet Yellen and the O'Biden administration in general have been talking about that they're not going to negotiate with the Republicans who passed a bill in the House, and it's going to the Senate. So legislatively, the O'Biden administration is absolutely lying, not telling truth, because the Republicans have done something about the debt ceiling. And they're also requiring accountability on spending. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit as we look at the 14th Amendment and the prospects of using the 14th Amendment as a mechanism to raise the debt ceiling from administrative fiat, as I mentioned earlier, to the fact that when we look at Joseph Story's commentaries on the Constitution and what Story is writing about how Congress can raise money and what that debt should be and how the debt is taken care of, folks, as I've said hundreds of times on this program, that we are nowhere close to original intent. Not an iota at the moment. It's just amazing. There's little crumbles and crumbs and corners that have some foundational truths and looking at executing it. But for the greatest majority of the swamp, the evil has consumed and has implemented, as I always have talked about, the Kozak plan of a parliamentary democracy on top of our constitutional republic. And go back into the past programs of how Nancy Pelosi used parliamentary procedure and parliamentary mechanisms for the 2020 election to put the traitor communist Biden administration, and not even communist, globalist, the evil administration into power. So with that, I don't want to continue into a diatribe of any nation or any, well, of our nation and so on. But let's go to Cornell Law and let's take a look at the 14th Amendment. In particular, a lot of people look at it around the civil rights issues and all of that, but that's not what we're focusing on here. We're focusing on the Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. And it reads like this, and I'm going to read it slowly so that it can kind of get into your head a little bit. The validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave. But all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. I'm going to take you down a couple twists, especially on that last phrase, if you will, or how they try to legally use each one of these sections. But at the moment, And we'll finish off in these last 5 minutes, and then we'll carry into the second segment. So those that only listen to the first and third segment, you're going to have to go to the second segment to get into the depth of what I'm talking about. But I am going to tease you with that last clause, because it's called a clause or phrase, but the last two clauses. Let me do this. I'll tease you, and then I'm going to go back where I want to go. Or any claim. We're going to start with these last two clauses. Or any claim for the loss of emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal or void. So just with those two phrases right there, what's illegal and void when it comes to the slavery or loss of any slave or loss due to emancipation, where is reparation legal? Where is paying for reparation legal? Because if they're causing that and calling on this and then using the 14th Amendment, the 13th and 14th Amendment as the validity for paying reparations, let's see, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. Let's leave that one out there. Leave that, think about that. But let's go back to the beginning and look at this interpretation, and there's nobody that does a good write-up on it. I searched, really, did a lot of searching, and there's those that do some vague writing, and that's in your references that you can read about it on the vagueness around this clause in Section 4, is that the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, so they're using the authorized by law clause, because anything between a paragraph, parentheses, they call a clause. And they argue legal arguments to the, to the sky, to the moon, to Mars, to Pluto, on this whole idea of what's between these commas. So they go on to here that including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion shall not be questioned. So when they try to establish, and it's going to be very interesting to figure out how the Biden administration is going to set up their legal authority to increase the debt ceiling by virtue of saying that the public debt authorized by law, and then the inclusionary phrase, shall not be questioned. So are they going to take and try and say that a lot of what the Biden administration is doing and what has been authorized for payment is under the false claims that January 6th is an insurrection? Or are they going to take and say, oh no, because of Obama's fundamentally wanting to take and change America and everything that they have done, especially since the Obama administration, is insurrection, and therefore everything that Congress has passed, especially the Democrats' Congresses, that, oh, that's all part of insurrection and rebellion, so therefore all of those payments have to be honored. But what are they going to argue? That becomes the question on how to use this 14th Amendment to take and raise the debt ceiling. Whereas Congress, having the sole authority, the House of Representatives in particular, having the sole authority around funding the government, has come up with a mechanism to raise the debt ceiling, but also to control the debt. And administratively, from a separation of powers perspective, boy, we're taking and walking on some real dicey areas. And the arguments are coming just fast and furious. And for the general citizen, for we the people, it is a absolute conflagration of confusion. And purposefully, because ideologies are fighting with one another. They're crossing the boundaries of total disassociation and mergers of authority. And we'll get more into the disassociation and mergers of authorities when we come back in the next segment and Samuel Adams returns. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second segment of Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists did get it right. And this segment, we're going to continue on with some resources in relationship to the 14th Amendment and the impacts that it has had in society. But with that, I want to go over some of the rules of constitutional interpretation, how they've been abandoned and perverted, what has happened with this doctrine from the 14th Amendment, as well as from the Bill of Rights called the Incorporation Document, and the references on its legal and historical fallacy, as it's a bunch of nonsense. But first, let's take a look at understanding the power to take and raise money, the power to borrow money and then to regulate commerce, but in particular to borrow money. This is coming from Joseph Story, Justice Joseph Story, and his commentaries on the Constitution, 1833. It's out of Book 3, Chapter 15. And what he writes is what we don't do anymore. I mean, we'll talk about it when we get into the other sections on rules of interpretation in particular, is that Justice Story is ignored for the most part, even with the major conservative judges that are on the federal bench, including the Supreme Court. And that's a lot because their ideologies, where they're established, as well as from the fact of who they're using to as their clerks in these courts to help these judges make their determinations and historically find the information that needs to be touched on to adjudicate something or to interpret the Constitution. But Story is very, very clear in this section, and the reference is there at samueladamsreturns.net over my shoulder. You can go there and see the reference. And this one is where Story goes, having finished this examination of the power of taxation and of the accompanying restrictions and prohibitions, the other powers of Congress will now be examined in the order in which they stand in the eighth section. So section 8 of what? Article 1 delineates the powers of Congress. Now, the one that came up next is to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Story is very clear in this, is that this power to borrow seems indispensable to the sovereignty and existence of a national government, flat out. Governments need to be able to borrow money. And the timing is timing for when to borrow and why to borrow is critical to understand. And under the foundation of the Constitution, with the fact that now, what does it mean to go to war? What does it mean to express the ideas and maintain what is going on with commerce? So the two are somewhat tied together, but yet they're not. So what he goes on to say is even under the Confederation, this power was expressly delegated. It was delegated to the states to raise the money. And even in the federal Constitution, it was initially delegated. The mechanisms was not by direct taxation. He covers that in the other chapter. So you have to go read Story on that, because what we have with the income tax is really a violation of the Constitution, and that amendment should have never passed. So that's a whole nother story. But the remarks here is unquestionably just that it is a power indispensably connected with that of raising revenue, with the duty of protection which that power imposes on the general government. So it's to protect the country. But though in times of peace it may not be ordinarily necessary to anticipate the revenues of a state, Yet the experience of all nations must convince us that the burden and expense of 1 year in a time of war may more than equal the ordinary revenue of 10 years. Hence, a debt is almost unavoidable. So he keeps the whole idea of the need to raise money in the context of war. So when you think about our modern time and you think about these continuous wars, and you think about then all of the different departments that now encompass the general federal government, it's always wartime stuff. So if you take and you do look at story and you take and put it into the context of, well, it's okay to raise money like that and indenture the people, because that's what we're doing, we're making slaves of every citizen, that what we have going on here is, well, if you're in time of war, then it's justifiable. But when you're not, then, you know, what's the reason to take and go after and extending and increasing the debt? There is no rational reason to do that except for overspending. And it's supposed to be limited. So the government of the United States has on several occasions in times of profound peace obtained large loans, among which a striking illustration of the economy and convenience of such arrangements will be found in the creation of a stock on purchases of Louisiana. So they borrowed money to make and do the Louisiana purchase. That makes sense? Apparently it did. So when we take and we look at the granting of the power is incompatible with any restraining or controlling power, and the Declaration of Supremacy in the Constitution is a declaration that no such restraining or controlling power shall be exercised. So even Story looks at this and like, what does it mean when you go out there and you just raise money? But what for? What justifies it? And we're spending money in such unjustifiable manners. They're all ideologically based. Where does that come into an understanding of the true meaning of general welfare of the nation? And where does that come into play, which we're really going to talk about in the next segment, on the idea of federalism and where the states have rights in the whole mechanisms of what are we raising the money for? Well, you know, I got to tell you is that the states have lost so much. And that moves me over into the impact of the 14th Amendment, especially on the Bill of Rights. This was written by Herbert W. Titus. And most of all, the primary references for this section here are from Loening Institute, one of my favorite institutes on the Constitution. And in this treatise, as some people call it, is that you go from 1833 until 1871, Supreme Court cases. It was unchallenged and held that the Bill of Rights applied only to the general government. The states were to be limited by the bills of rights in the several states' constitutions, except as explicitly provided for in the original Constitution, the original U.S. Constitution. But things happened then. We know that the Civil War, 13th Amendment came in, and what that did in taking and freeing the slaves and giving them new sets of rights, and the court cases that went with that. But then the 14th Amendment came into play because a lot of the states were taking and being repressive to all of those freed slaves in so many different ways on what they could buy, what they couldn't buy, were they really citizens? Could they vote? Could they not vote? There was just a mess. It was a mess. There was, with the 13th Amendment, arguably, there was nothing there that really prepared for people to gain their liberty. I was going to take a path down that on what's going to happen with all the illegals coming in, but that's a whole different argument. But trust me, what's going on is they're trying to apply the 14th Amendment for allowing the illegals. That's happening right now as well. So there was a proposal to take and enact laws, and under this was that all laws which shall be necessary and proper to secure the citizens of each state, all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, and to all persons in the several states, equal protection in the rights of life, liberty, and property. Now, this was in the 39th Congress in 1866, but that didn't go anywhere from a legislative perspective. But instead, the 14th Amendment was proposed, and in that proposal, language was changed in saying that the privileges and immunities contained in that initial draft, instead of protecting all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, the new version protected the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States. And or, big difference in then how things were going to get interpreted. So this whole shift, and just to summarize quickly, is that the 14th Amendment, as it started going through and being used in various court cases, the Slaughterhouse case being one of the largest actions that happened. And in that Slaughterhouse case, what happened there was that butchers were saying that, wait a minute, Louisiana was allowing for protectionism of the business to certain people, and it was impacting their rights to do business. And so the privileges and immunities section of the article, which became the privileges or immunities, was what was used in that Slaughterhouse case. And what happened is it flipped everything on applying the Bill of Rights now to the states. And this has been done over and over and over again in applying the Bill of Rights, which is supposed to be only to the federal government. Now it's being applied to the states. It shifts everything in law. It shifts every way that we look at even the application of debt in Clause 4. So, due process changed with the 14th Amendment. What did that happen? What did that make? You'll have to read this for yourself. But it all goes back to where I'm going to point you now is on the rules of interpretation. The rules of interpretation are based on ideological differences. Just the only way to say it. And this is very, very important because the Slaughterhouse case was, again, that primary case, a landmark decision that took and set what is now precedent, and it even flip-flopped back and forth a couple of times in the courts, and in the Supreme Court in particular, and it's all on how those with ideological differences that are, I will say, godless in understanding or implementation, put it into effect. And even in these modern courts, they use what's called the incorporation doctrine a lot. There's a reference to that as well. I'm not going to get into the details of that, but let's suffice it to say right now, when we take and we look at how they're trying to manipulate and have been manipulating for 100 years the 14th Amendment, just think about Article 5 and what's going on with this whole group that's out there pushing for a constitutional convention. What we can learn, if anything, from the 14th Amendment is that the unintended consequences based on interpretation even if the original intent and language of an amendment had a purist idea at the period of time that it was being implemented, which I'm not so sure the 14th had, but even if it had, then the interpretations of the court further down the road will never be known, because whose ideology will be predominant? So no to an Article 5 Convention of States. That's ridiculous. Sam Adams would have been against everything going on. Come on back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this last segment of Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists did get it right. This is Tom Navulas, your host, and we're going to shift it up. Go to SamuelAdamsReturns.net to get the notes on the program. For those that only get the first and third segment, I highly recommend that you go back and either listen to the full podcast or, you know, check out the videos there as well. And please sign up to receive the videos, sign up to receive the newsletter, pass it on, help others to also connect with the program. And, you know, for those that are willing, we can always use a couple extra bucks in the bucket to help defray the various administrative costs that we have to keep the website up and all of that. Once again, let's jump right into what I want to talk about. We talked about the potentials of utilizing the 14th Amendment Clause 4 by the Biden administration to raise the debt ceiling. And I covered that in a little bit more details on the 14th Amendment and in that area in the second segment. So check that out. But what I wanted to drop to today as well is that as I was listening to the recaps of the Trump message there, or whatever you want to call it, call it his fabulous performance on CNN, that I was also going through and looking at what was happening out here on this whole idea of Christian nationalism. And actually read a number of different articles. One that really piqued my interest was there on the Law and Liberty, talking about it being a personal Christian nationalism, as this author dove into the idea of Stephen Wolfe's book, The Case for Christian Nationalism. And we hear about it, you know, especially those that are in the Reform circles or in the evangelical circles, you're hearing more about it than most people, I'm sure. But if you're not, let me tell you something right now. Christian nationalism is not new. And what I want to do right now is I want to give you an example that other countries in modern history are using the fundamental ideas of Christian nationalism. You know why? Because they're biblical. And whether they understand the Christian portion of it, the idea of federalism goes all the way back to the author of the article commenting on Wolfe's book really hit a note for me, because he was talking about both Augustine and what Augustine wrote in City of God in relationship to how Christianity should function within the home, within local society, and within a nation. But then he hit somebody else there to me that I have done a lot of studying on, not as much as I'd like to, but a lot, because I included information about him on federalism in my book. And that was none other than Althusius. So we're going to jump over right now, and I'm going to talk about Althusius from that perspective, that nationalism is Christian, it's biblically foundationally true, and it goes back through all of Europe and into our Puritan founders. Now, the person that did the most writing about this, and the person that I'm referring to in specific in this is no other than Daniel J. Elazar. Dr. Elazar is a Jewish historian. I wouldn't call him a theologian from the Jewish perspective, or maybe has some rabbinical background. But this guy wrote the best stuff ever when it comes to what is the foundational government, even of America. So here is the article, or here is the paper that he wrote on Althusius and federalism as a grand design. And he talks about this from a perspective of the studies in the kibbutz system in Israel. And what is that kibbutz system, and how is that modeled? How is it for the reconstruction of society? How does that work from the family all the way through to then that local governing independent body? And then how does that fit in to the whole nation of Israel? Well, Althusius wrote this, and I'll give you the resource for this, and as well as Althusius's specific work that he did on Politica, which is about the foundational fundamental designs of a Christian nationalism in a federal society. What is federalism from that point of view? And then what we want to look at is at this article is that Elazar actually goes back from some interviews in 1973 that he did in Yugoslavia with the Yugoslav political scientists. And this political scientist, Jovan Djordjevic, was a real close friend of Marshal Tito, a dictator. Now, what's interesting is that you're looking at what are constitutions, what are republic constitutions in general? How did that fit not only there in what was a bad Yugoslavian republic and what was that model, but what is and how does a democracy function within a republican form of government? And that's what Elazar takes us through in detail. Now, he talks about Althusius was careful to acknowledge the first grand federalist design was in the Bible. Most particularly the Old Testament. What he takes and he brings out is that how that structure was designed there from God's covenant. And this is where Elazar really shines. He's the best, even out of any of the Christian, modern Christian writers, on covenant. He understands the detail of covenant. So when I take and we look at this, and we look at what Althusius was studying in the scriptures, in that design, is that the covenant with Noah, that was establishing a biblical equivalent of what philosophers were later to term natural law, to the Jews' reaffirmation at the Sinai covenant, and especially under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, adopting the Torah as the constitution of their second commonwealth. The covenant, and using the Latin word of fodeus, from whence federal, the motif, comes, is the central biblical worldview. And it's the basis of all relationships and mechanisms for defining and allocating authority and the foundation of biblical political teaching. These are the things the majority of the evangelicals out there have no concept of. And they're arguing from, oh, the biblical view of this, and we're not supposed to be involved in that, and this, that, and the same old nonsense. Even if they do understand church history, they don't understand the foundations of a republic as that political teaching. throughout the whole scriptures. Now, what I want you to take a look at, we're going to go through just a few points here that Dr. Elazar brings out. The biblical grand design for humankind, not just a government, for humankind, for the human race. There's only one race, the human race, is federal. And it's in three different ways. It's based upon a network of covenants beginning with those between God and man. Covenantal. Three ways. Covenants beginning with those between God and man, which then weave the web of human, especially political relationships in a federal way. That is through pact, association, and consent. So just in that framework alone. The 16th century, this worldview was recreated by the Reformed wing of the Protestantism as federal theology, from which Althusians, the Huguenots, the Scottish Covenanters, and the English and American Puritans developed political theories and principles of constitutional design. So every evangelical out there, all you Catholics out there, learn truth. Learn truth. This is truth. Number two, then we talk about from a biblical grand design for humankind. Number two, the classic biblical commonwealth was a fully articulated federation of tribes instituted and reaffirmed by covenant to function under a common constitution and laws. Any and all constitutional changes in the Israelite polity were introduced through covenanting, and even after the introduction of the monarchy, the federal element was maintained until most of the tribal structure were destroyed by the external forces. So there you have the biblical vision of a restored commonwealth in the messianic era envisages a reconstruction of the tribal federation. That's how the Jews see it. Certain of the American Puritans and many Americans of the revolutionary era, among others, were inspired by the biblical polity to seek federal arrangements for their polities. And then number three, biblical vision for the end days, the messianic era. Interesting. So even when you look at Revelation, the book of Revelation shows Christ as king over all kingdoms of the earth. So whether you're looking at it from the Jewish perspective of a messianic era, or if you're looking at it from revelations of King Jesus of all kings, what? Bow down to him. It is all coming back to that federated confederation, a league of nations, preserving its own integrity while accepting a common divine covenant and constitutional order. God runs ordered government. Federalism is the mechanism. Now, I'm going to stop here for a moment. You can read more on this as well. I wanted to give you the concept of that grand design. Most importantly, right now, when we look at back to the beginning of the program with the 14th Amendment and how destructive the interpretations and the bad, false, ideological interpretations have affected the federalism of these 50 United States and territories have been destroyed under the mechanisms of interpretation, bad interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And so now we're going to watch and see what happens when it comes down to raising the debt limit. How will that be justified? And we're watching and we're seeing the continued destruction. So your job is to understand the truth and to force your local elected to know how to reinstitute federalism into our form of governance. Take a look at it for your family, too. It's interesting. Hey, Sam Adams knew all about federalism, and he was a great promoter of it. So come on back next week when Samuel Adams does return.